We're going to be relying for our information on Ben Menashe's new book entitled The Prophets of War. That's spelled P-R-O-F-I-T-S, subtitled Inside the Secret U.S.-Israeli Arms Network. That's authored by Ari Ben Menashe, capital A-R-I, capital B-E-N hyphen, capital M-E-N-A-S-H-E, published in hardcover by the Sheridan Square Press, and copyrighted, let me see, is it 1992 or 1993? Copyright 1992 by Ari Ben Menashe. Now, again, according at least to Ari Ben Menashe, the Promise software program began as a Big Brother project developed by or conceptualized by Rafi Eitan, one of Ari Ben Menashe's collaborators in the Israeli intelligence system, and according to Ben Menashe, an individual who devised the stratagem of utilizing elements of the Palestinian movement to stage terrorist incidents which discredited the Palestinian movement. We have gone into in the past in RFA 38 not only the Achille Lauro incident, but also the Hindawi incident in which there was an attempted bombing of an El Al airliner. Both of those, according to Ben Menashe, were essentially Western intelligence provocations. What we're looking at with Ben Menashe's book is primarily the Mossad end of things. Bear in mind that with the Iran-Contra scandal, as with counterterrorism, both as a propaganda theme and as a working consideration, the U.S. and Israelis collaborated very closely in the 1980s. We're looking at the Mossad end of things here. In the past, we have looked primarily at the U.S. end of things. Note also, this is Ari Ben Menashe's account. Not necessarily consistent with others. Not necessarily incorrect because of that either. But for what it's worth, here is Ari Ben Menashe's account of the development of the Promise software. And note that the rationale for developing this Big Brother software, as Ari Ben Menashe quite properly terms it, was, quote, anti-terrorist scheme. It was anti-terrorism, I should say. Ben Menashe writes, one of Eitan's pet projects was an anti-terrorist scheme involving a sinister, Big Brother-like computer program named Promise, capital P-R-O-M-I-S. It was through Eitan that I became involved in it. This was not joint committee work per se, but many of these same people who worked on our arms to Iran operation worked on Promise also. The most prominent of these was British media baron Robert Maxwell, who made a fortune out of it. Of course, Robert Maxwell died when he fell or was pushed off his yacht off the coast of Spain, supposedly a suicide. Many have disputed that particular information. His death came shortly after allegations in a book by Seymour Hersh, in which it was alleged that Robert Maxwell was deeply involved in the Iran-Contra scandal, among other things, and those allegations coming from Ari Ben Menashe. Continuing with Ben Menashe's account, through some of his companies, the Israelis and the Americans were eventually able to tap into the secrets of numerous intelligence networks around the world, including Britain, Canada, Australia, and many others, and set into motion the arrest, torture, and murder of thousands of innocent people in the name of, quote, anti-terrorism, unquote. The last sentence again. Through some of his companies, his is Maxwell, through some of his companies, the Israelis and the Americans were eventually able to tap into the secrets of numerous intelligence networks around the world, including Britain, Canada, Australia, and many others, and set into motion the arrest, torture, and murder of thousands of innocent people in the name of, quote, anti-terrorism, unquote. And again, what we're looking at here is the evolution of, quote, anti-terrorism, unquote, from anti-terrorism per se into totalitarian government and fascism, or the institutions of totalitarian government and fascism. Continuing with Ben Menashe's account, the frightening story of the Promise program began in the United States in the late 1960s when communications expert William Hamilton, who had spent time in Vietnam during the war setting up listening posts to monitor the communist forces, was assigned to a research and development unit of the U.S. National Security Agency. Fluent in Vietnamese, Hamilton created a computerized Vietnamese-English dictionary for the intelligence agency. While working there, Hamilton also started work on an extremely sophisticated database program that could interface with data banks in other computers. By the early 1970s, he was well on the way with his research and realized he had a keg of dynamite in his hands. The program he was developing would have the ability to track the movements of vast numbers of people around the world. Dissidents or citizens who needed to be kept under watch would be hard put to move freely again without Big Brother keeping an eye on their activities. When Hamilton saw that the program he was building had so much potential, He resigned from the National Security Agency and took over a nonprofit corporation called InsLaw, established to develop a software program for legal purposes. The InsLaw program would be able to cross-check various court actions and, through cross-referencing, find a common denominator. For example, if a wanted person moved to a new state and established a new identity before being arrested, the program would search out aspects of his life and cases he had been involved in and match them up. Hamilton put his knowledge to use in InsLaw, and when his bosses at NSA found out, they were not at all happy. Their argument was that as an employee of the agency, he had no right to take knowledge gleaned there to another organization. By 1981, Hamilton came up with an enhanced program. What he had actually done was given birth to a monster. InsLaw was turned into a profit-making organization, and Hamilton copyrighted his enhanced version. Believing that InsLaw was invaluable for law enforcement agencies, Hamilton sent promise to the Justice Department in 1981 offering them leasing rights. The more they used it, the more profit InsLaw would make. The Hamilton program was sent to the NSA for study, but in time, through arrangements made with Attorney General Edwin Meese III, Hamilton got his program back. The Justice Department declined to lease the program from InsLaw, and it soon transpired they were using, quote, their own, unquote, promise. So was the NSA. The U.S. government had its own plans for promise. Some American officials thought the Israelis might be able to sell it to intelligence agencies around the world. So in 1982, Earl Bryan approached Rafi Eitan. After studying the program, Eitan had a brilliant idea. He called me in to see him. Quote, we can use this program to stamp out terrorism by keeping track of everyone, unquote, he said. Again quoting, but not only that. We can find out what our enemies know, too, unquote. I stared at him for a moment. Suddenly I realized what he was talking about. Benzona Ata Tzodek, B-E-N-Z-O-N-A-A-T-A-T-S-O-D-E-K. This is Hebrew. Son of a expletive deleted. You're right, I exclaimed. All we had to do was, quote, bug, unquote, the program when it was sold to our enemies. It would work like this. A nation's spy organization would buy promise and have it installed in its computers at headquarters. Using a modem, the spy network would then tap into the computers of such services as the telephone company, the water board, other utility commissions, credit card companies, etc. Promise would then search for specific information. For example, if a person suddenly started using more water and more electricity and making more phone calls than usual, it might be suspected he had guests staying with him. Promise would then start searching for the records of his friends and associates, and if it was found that one had stopped using electricity and water, it might be assumed, based on other records stored in Promise, that the missing person was staying with the subject of the investigation. This would be enough to have him watched if, for example, he had been involved in previous conspiracies. Promise would search through its records and produce details of those conspiracies, even though the person might have been operating under a different name in the past. The program was sophisticated enough to find a detail that would reveal his true identity. This information might also be of interest to Israel, which is where the trapdoor would come into play. By dialing into the central computer of any foreign intelligence agency using Promise, an Israeli agent with a modem need only type in certain secret code words to gain access. Then he could ask for information on the person and get it all on his computer screen. According to computer experts I have spoken to in Israel, the trapdoor is undetectable. Nations receiving Promise might wonder if there was any trickery by Israel, but they would not be able to find anything, especially as it was experts provided by Israel who installed the program. Rafi Eitan did not want to risk having a trapdoor developed in Israel. Word might leak back that the Israelis had been bugging software and then handing it out to others. He didn't even suggest that the NSA develop the trapdoor because he had a great sense of national pride. As far as he was concerned, it was Israel's idea and would remain so, yet it still had to be kept secret. Eitan decided it would be best if a computer whiz could be found outside the country. I knew just the man for the job. Yehuda Ben Hanan, B-E-N-H-A-N-A-N, ran a small computer company of his own called Software and Engineering Consultants based in Chatsworth, California. I had grown up with him, but I didn't want him to know that I was scouting him out for a possible job. I had to sound him out to find out if he was a blabbermouth. When I called on him, I told him I was in California on holiday and had decided to look him up. We chatted about our days as kids, and he introduced me to his wife, a Brazilian Jew. I decided he was right for the job. He was not conspiracy-minded, and it was unlikely his suspicions would be aroused. 5 days after I left, he was approached by an Israeli man who hired him to build an external access to a program. Yehuda wasn't told what the program was all about. He was simply given blueprints and set about his work for a $5,000 fee. With the trapdoor in place, Rafi Eitan selected Jordan as the nation on which it would be tested. Earl Bryan made the sale through his company, Hadron, H-A-D-R-O-N. Bryan accurately represented it as a program that would help stamp out the Palestinian dissidents who had long been a thorn in the side of King Hussein. A team of Hadron computer experts went to Amman and began setting up Promise software for Jordanian military intelligence. They also hooked it up with the various computers that had already been sold to Jordan by IBM in the late 1970s. These computers were linked to the water company, the telephone company, and every other public utility. The Hadron team did one more thing. They hooked the Promise program to a small computer attached to a telephone line in an apartment in Amman. That apartment was occupied by a businessman who had close connections with Mossad. From his home, he was able to dial up various public services as well as the military and use Promise to find out everything about everybody, as well as to tap into Jordan's military secrets. Because of his business as an importer-exporter, he had often had an excuse to fly to Vienna. He would take the New York-bound Aliyah Royal Jordanian Airlines flight from Amman and get off in Vienna. There, he would pass computer disks loaded with information to a Mossad contact. So what Israel and the Americans learned was that the system was workable. The two countries also found out that the Jordanians had a tracking system of their own which was being used against Palestinian movements. Israel and the U.S. were laughing. The Jordanians tracked the Palestinians, our man tapped into their information, and we knew as much about the whereabouts of one terrorist or another as the Jordanians did. The Americans came up with the idea of selling this valuable program to governments and their intelligence networks all over the world. But first, they had to produce their own version of Promise with the secret trapdoor. The Americans handed a copy of their program to Wackenhut, a Florida-based company that worked for the U.S. intelligence community. The company also had a computer development unit located on the Cabazon Indian Reservation in Southern California. The Indian reservation was used by Wackenhut, which was contracted by the Technical Services Division of the CIA for developing special equipment such as special-purpose electronics, anti-terrorist devices, etc., as well as hallucinogenic drugs. It was done on an Indian reservation because there was no state jurisdiction, and the federal authorities would have jurisdiction. And the federal authorities who would have jurisdiction turned a blind eye to the operation. It was here that the trapdoor was built into the U.S. version of Promise based on Israeli information. The CIA group that was to use Promise had not handed the program back to the NSA to have the trapdoor fitted by them for the simple reason that they didn't want the NSA to know about it. Interagency competition was fierce. Only this small CIA group, headed by Robert Gates, who was to become head of the Central Intelligence Agency in October of 1991, was in on the secret. So we now had a small group in Israel and a small group in the U.S. that knew about the trapdoor. The next step for both Israel and the United States was to find a neutral company through which the Doctored Promise program could be sold. It was agreed that the head of the company had to be a man who would be trusted to keep intelligence secrets, who had contacts with both Western and East Bloc countries, and who had a respected businessman's image. The man they came up with was Robert Maxwell. Robert Maxwell, whose body now lies in Judaism's most revered burial ground on the Mount of Olives overlooking Jerusalem's walled city, formed his ties with Israel in the early 1960s when a meeting was arranged for him with Yitzhak Shamir, who was then in Mossad operations in Europe. Shamir's was an important role, soliciting information from all the European-based agencies employed by Mossad. Interrupting, of course, the Mossad, M-O-S-S-A-D, is the Israeli intelligence service. The rendezvous with Maxwell was arranged through MAPAM, M-A-P-A-M, United Workers Party in Israel, which was part of the labor movement and had close connections with Maxwell's left-wing colleagues in the British Labor Party. The two men were brought together by Aviezer Yari, A-V-I-E-Z-E-R, capital Y-A apostrophe A-R-I, a kibbutz member and one of the ideological leaders of MAPAM. Uppermost in Yari's mind was making contact with the Soviets, so it was a natural move to put Shamir in touch with Maxwell, who had intelligence links with the Soviets beginning in World War II. Shamir's past as a Stern Gang terrorist appeared to make this an unlikely pairing, but Mossad was keen to make any connections it could with the KGB, and the belief in Tel Aviv was that Maxwell, for all his pride in faithfully serving in the British Army, remained on good terms with, quote, friends, unquote, in the East Bloc. Maxwell, who had been elected a British Labour MP in 1964, and Shamir shared an antipathy for the Americans and were to become friends of heart and spirit. Rafi Eitan knew of Maxwell's long association with Shamir and with Israel, so he suggested that the British mogul would be the perfect front for selling promise. The approach to Maxwell on Israeli prompting was made in 1984 by Senator John Tower, an old friend of the publishers, who was close to the then Vice President George Bush. In fact, many years before, Tower had helped Bush get into Congress. Always interested in military and intelligence affairs, Tower had served as chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee. According to Maxwell, when Bush was head of the CIA in 1976, Tower approached Maxwell to connect him and Bush secretly on a person-to-person basis with various Soviet intelligence people. Last couple of sentences again. Now note here that this is in exactly the period where former CIA Director George Bush is heading up the Vice President's Task Force on Counterterrorism and or working with Oliver North on the crisis management superstructures or infrastructure. And note again that Maxwell, at least according to Ari Ben-Menashe, was involved in trafficking the promised software abroad, that he was very close to John Tower. I would note that John Tower was killed in the crash of a plane back in 1991. Robert Maxwell died under strained circumstances also. Note that both, apparently, were quite close to George Bush and had worked together with George Bush when Bush was director of the Central Intelligence Agency. Last couple of sentences again. The approach to Maxwell, on Israeli prompting, was made in 1984 by Senator John Tower, an old friend of the publishers, who was close to the then Vice President George Bush. In fact, many years before, Tower had helped Bush get into Congress. Always interested in military and intelligence affairs, Tower had served as chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee. According to Maxwell, when Bush was head of the CIA in 1976, Tower approached Maxwell to connect him and Bush secretly on a person-to-person basis with various Soviet intelligence people. When Maxwell delivered, Tower became his friend for life. With the relationship strengthening over the years, Tower subsequently was appointed a director of Maxwell's Macmillan Publishing Company in the U.S. Tower's approach to Maxwell to use his network of companies to market promise was made on behalf of the CIA group headed by Gates. So again, note here that the rationale for developing the promise software was, quote, counterterrorism, unquote, and that ultimately it has evolved into something resembling a Big Brother is watching you sort of device, and moving way beyond the arena of counterterrorism. Note again the allegations by Ben-Menashe of a relationship vis-a-vis promise between Maxwell and Israeli and U.S. intelligence. Note that John Tower was tabbed by Maxwell as an individual who helped to cement the relationship Tower was the person the relationship between Maxwell and George Bush. Note also that Tower and Maxwell are described here as friends for life. They're now both dead. That doesn't mean, of course, that everything here that Ben-Menashe says is gospel, but dead men tell no tales, and it's a sense we're not going to be hearing any more from John Tower or Robert Maxwell, whatever the nature of the true nature of the circumstances of their death. And it's interesting, too, to note that this period in which this is being developed is exactly the period in which George Bush was working with Oliver North on the various national security infrastructures that were developed under the rationale of, quote, counterterrorism, unquote. I would note, too, it's interesting that Maxwell ultimately took over the Macmillan Publishing Company. Priscilla Johnson Macmillan, who married the Macmillan of Macmillan, was one of the people who had interviewed Lee Harvey Oswald after he defected to the Soviet Union, And it was, actually, she interviewed him, I believe it was when he came back to the U.S. rather than in the Soviet Union proper, although it may have been the Soviet Union proper. I'd have to go back and check it. In any event, she interviewed Lee Harvey Oswald. She then wrote a book called Marina and Lee, which is disinformation, which basically endorses the lone nut hypothesis. I mention this because it was Senator John Tower who Lee Harvey Oswald contacted in order to get back into the United States. Again, echoes of a distant event, echoes which continue forward to the present time. So again, I present this simply by way of taking a look as sort of a foreshadowing of where we're going to be going with our examination of, quote, anti-terrorism, unquote. I can appreciate that many people, many members of the listening audience at this point must be kind of sick of my discussions of the involvement of elements of our intelligence system with international terrorism, but ultimately where we're going with this is an examination of the evolution of the national security infrastructures set up under the rationale of counterterrorism, and we are going to examine their evolution into a machinery which could ultimately eliminate all democracy in the United States, which could establish martial law, totalitarian rule, and overt German-style fascism in response to any one of a number of, quote, unforeseen, unquote, emergencies. And this concludes this particular segment of Radio Free America number 38, The Terror Connection, Part 3. It also concludes the prepared portion of One Step Beyond.